Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount. Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's cool fact of the day is, when you get a kidney transplant, they actually leave your old kidneys in your body most of the time, and the new transplant kidney goes somewhere in your pelvis. That's actually kind of gross.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's guest, if you're watching us on YouTube, you can already see him sitting there, or watching us on iTunes, on our new iTunes video channel, is Jan Irwin, who runs a website called Gnostic Media. And he's here today to talk about 2 things. One of them is something called Trivium. And the Trivium way of thinking is really useful when you're looking at how your internal dialogue works, or how you communicate with other people, or how you rationally look at things you hear, especially in marketing or in mass media. So I think this is going to be an enlightening episode that's full of useful things for you. But we're also going to talk about transhumanism. And I'm very interested to hear what the kind of the opposing view here is. If you haven't come across Gnostic Media before, it's a website you could say is a little bit out there. Jan, do you agree, is your website considered to be a bit out there?
Oh, I don't know what you mean by out there. I mean, we publish a lot of cutting-edge research, and we do publish a lot of primary documentation and things like that that people can fact-check. But if you're not into fact-checking and verifying citations, it's probably out there. I mean, if you like just made-up stuff that you pull from the Pleiades or something, our stuff is probably pretty out there in comparison to that.
From the Pleiades, I love it.
And by the way, I could have said Uranus, but you know, the Pleiades.
Welcome to the show. What a great opening. And when I say out there, I don't mean out there as in a negative, you know, fairyland. But you've got some pretty alternative views, and you do an almost obsessive amount of research and fact checking. I've seen your large database of relationships between different things, and you're definitely spending a lot of cognitive and rational cycles looking for the truth behind things, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. So let's jump right in on this about the Trivium method. Can you help our listeners understand?
Sure. Well, you know, the Trivium method is actually something that someone named Gino Dinning brought to my show back in 2009. And it's based off of the ancient classical seven liberal arts, although it's sort of the inverse of it. In ancient Roman times, only the elite class, the ruler class, were allowed to study the Trivium and Quadrivium, or the classical seven liberal arts. And they basically use these arts to keep the slaves under control. And so what we've done is we've sort of leveled the playing field and put the Trivium out for all of the slaves instead. And so, you know, everybody gets to see how these tools work and
when
how
you say, when you say all of the slaves, you're talking about, like, everyone listening to the show?
Well, the general masses of, if you're not a billionaire, you're a slave. Let's put it that way. And so, you know, when you get into the classical seven liberal arts and you begin to study how they put logic and thinking together, essentially, and especially for what's fed to the people, you can see that there is a constant barrage of intentional manipulation going on there, especially in the mass media, television commercials, radio commercials, pop culture, media idols, all of this sort of stuff. It's all designed to play on people's emotions. Now, the Trivium is grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And it's essentially, it breaks down really simply. Grammar is the components that make up reality, all the things that we look at, my microphone, the microphone cable, the camera that we're looking at, the computer in front of me, etc. These are items, they're all nouns, actually. And so when I see them, I can identify each one and know all the things here on my desk that I'm dealing with. And so essentially the grammar aspect is who, what, where, and when. And then the logic aspect is actually why. And, you know, you're a computer, former computer tech designer guy. You helped invent cloud technology, et cetera. So if we think about it in terms of computers, grammar would be the input into the computer, like the keyboard or putting something into the CD-ROM drive, and it's getting the information in there. The logic aspect would be the processing. And it would be removing any contradictions in the things that we see, recognizing contradictions as errors or lies, spotting any fallacious arguments coming in, as well as fallacious arguments within our own minds, and making sure, you know, like a lot of the most common arguments against my research, they never address any of my research. They'll just name call at me. Okay, so, you know, what this is total avoidance. You kill the messenger and actually attack the messenger and completely avoid the actual message itself. Now, the last aspect of the Trivium is rhetoric. And so in terms of a computer, that would be like the output, what you see on the screen, what comes through the speakers, what comes out of the printer, etc. So we have grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Now, if you were a computer and you put the logic aspect of the processing before input, what would happen? Essentially, you have a system failure, or as the old adage, garbage in, garbage out, or we might have a virus and a complete collapse. But essentially, the computer, any output that would come out of the computer, it has to make up on its own without any input. And so, you know, that was my joke regarding the Pleiades a minute ago. We have to channel it. We have to make it up. And we ignore any facts in reality around us. We basically, you know, this world, these things, you and I here talking, it doesn't exist.
So now if I'm driving in my car in traffic listening to this podcast, like a ton of people do now, how am I going to take what you've described there and apply that to what I'm doing now or what I'm going to do later today?
Well, you know, while you're driving, I suppose, if you're going down the freeway, you know, quick action response, obviously we have our animal primal instincts, but using a little bit of critical thinking and not thinking, oh, you know, well, you know, my ego is just something that's bad for me and it would be better if I just collided into this car. You know, you could actually use it to stop something. But, you know, here's the thing is you're dealing with all the items in your reality, all the things that you need to do, whether it's in the morning or in the afternoon. I have these business meetings. I have these things that I need to do. So what you're able to do is like you basically create a mental image of all of the nouns, all the things that you're dealing with. And then you can go through and figure out the most logical way to deal with them without using fallacies and things like that to come to conclusions. Like,
what's an example? Show me like a common fallacy conclusion loop that you're talking about.
Okay, well, a common fallacy would be like, well, you know, I'm supposed to have a meeting with this guy. He's been trying to have a meeting. He says it's important. I've never heard his message. I think he's an idiot or a jerk or whatever, so I'm going to dismiss his message. You know, here's the thing is if we think of it in terms of like, let's say it's the fool on the hill, okay? And one side of the hill, we have a village that's at war with the other side of the hill. And one day the village idiot, he comes running down. The army on the other side, they're coming to kill us. They're coming to kill us. And everybody said, oh, it's the fool on the hill. It's like the boy who cries wolf. Nobody wants to believe him. Or you can just, you know, I know this guy is the fool on the hill, but just in case, I'm going to go do some 5 cents reality checking. I'm going to go stick my head up over the hill and take a look. Oh, look at that. There's an army coming. Now I can go and organize myself and my troops and be prepared. So rather than dismissing information with fallacies, we take it in, we consider it, we look at it, and then we make a logical decision on it.
So in an attempt to break this down to some simple principles people can use, tell me if I've got this right. We're talking about applying a rational logic loop to whatever you perceive to verify that it's what's actually there.
Right. Okay. And not only that, but the loop itself has a way to check to make sure that the information really is there.
Okay.
Okay. So essentially what it is it's a systematic method for deriving certainty with any information coming in via the five senses. And so, you know, instead of saying, just a lot of times when people will hear things from outside sources and then they just repeat it without checking it. Okay.
Yeah,
so what
called,
you do is
that's called the internet, right?
Well, okay, and a lot of people say, well, anything is on the internet, so therefore it's wrong. But it's actually a systematic way to go through. Did the person use citations? Can I verify these citations when I look them up? Do they check out? Is the person using name calling to dismiss someone's entire argument? Do they use a straw man or false represent the argument? So like if you're approaching information, for instance, you would look at both sides of the information. Now, in my own case, I've done a lot of research on MKUltra and the psychedelic movement, et cetera. A lot of people will attack my research without ever reading it. They won't have a single iota of a clue of what my research is about. So what they'll do is they'll attack me name-calling because it challenges them. So then if you're able to sit them down and get them to look at the work first, then they're actually able to judge it and compare it. Now, sometimes there's cognitive dissonance and things like that. So then the idea with the logic aspect is we can recognize our own fallacies that we use to trip up our thinking and, you know, get back on the right path. Essentially, you know, what maybe a good metaphor would be, it's like we have a jar. And it's our slime jar, okay? And what we do is anytime our emotions start getting in the way, we open up the jar, we put our emotions in there, we close it up, and then we say, okay, now what are we looking at? Am I letting my emotions or beliefs of religion or love and relationships or of, you know, my biases about this or that fact get in the way versus the facts themselves? So it's essentially the way that our brains work naturally when we're not conditioned to think with a lot of fallacies. Now, logical fallacies, they basically come in three categories: relevance, presumption, and ambiguity. And so when we recognize these three different categories of fallacies, and these are just the informal fallacies or mostly spoken fallacies, and they're written or formal fallacies as well. But when we begin to recognize these fallacies, we can filter them out of our thoughts, verify the information, and then know for certain that that information is true or false.
Okay, let's assume that someone listening to this has said, all right, I want to try this, and I'm going to start doing it now. Like, what's step one?
Well, step one is I would actually take a good study of the Trivium. Like, for instance, our website, triviumeducation.com, we've put a ton of free information up there for people. Because of the history of the Trivium, we've never wanted to charge for the information, so we've put all of that information up on the Trivium Education website for free. But interestingly, when you're using it in daily life, it's always grammar, logic, rhetoric. But to start out, because some of the concepts in general grammar actually need a little bit of logic, we actually recommend people began studying a little bit of logic foundation first. Now, for us grown-ups, us adults learning this stuff, it's a little bit trickier because, you know, historically, the classical arts were taught in elementary or you know, grade school level. And so, you know, in a society that doesn't have it, the adults have to go through sort of an entirely different process to pick it up. I mean, you know, we were taught who, what, where, when, why, and how in second or third grade, but we never really got what it all meant. We never really got that who, what, where, when, why, and how is how we gather all knowledge around us from the entire universe, all those nouns, adjectives, everything that you see around you.
That doesn't pass my logic filter.
Okay, how's that?
The reason for that is that the auditory or visual ways you read,
sure,
which is visual or auditory, you hear
sure
words. You also
sure
hear bird song. You also
sure
smell things. You feel things. You taste things. Right.
Sure.
So what you're doing when you start using grammar on top of all those is you're now thinking in words, and you're obviously a word thinker. But there are people who are visual thinkers.
Sure.
And there are people who don't
so
even
now
speak who also okay are capable of logic. So I'm not sure it always
right
starts with grammar.
Well, you know, here's the thing is when we think in, when we put strings of logical ideas together, they're done in words. Okay, we have this word for a computer. I mean, we can talk about things that we can't identify. I mean, mystics love to bring up stuff to speculate about all day long. But two people who are capable of rational functionality should be able to say, you know, Dave, this is a microphone. You can see the microphone. Can we agree that this is a microphone? And you say, no, that's a horse. I mean, we have a serious problem here.
Well, except stevia. 20% of us think it tastes bitter and nasty, and 80% of us think it tastes sweet.
Okay.
So how do you resolve that kind of thing? Like some stuff that we perceive
okay
as important, yet we don't all perceive the same thing.
Okay. It's not necessarily if we like the flavor of stevia or dislike it. It's whether we can identify the stevia. It's whether, you know, I mean, if you and I can look on this page and we can see the words here and we can see, okay, right at the top, it says Dave Asprey there. So can you yep agree that that says Dave Asprey?
Of course.
So, okay, so we can agree. We can get on the same page. And in fact, that's what that means. Now, if we disagree that that says Dave Asprey, then we have a problem. And then you and I, if we're willing to recognize that there is an error somewhere, then we can go back and we can review it. Now, it's not to determine whether or not you like the chicken, the flavor of chicken better than beef. I mean, it's to determine the nouns chicken and beef exist, and that is there, are you eating chicken right now? I don't see you eating chicken right now.
Okay.
I mean, you're not dribbling it off your face or anything. So we're able to take things in from five sense reality and verify them. Aesthetics, things like this get into the higher arts, you know, fine wines, fine foods, whatever you want to get into. These get into the aesthetics, things that are above the quadrivium in the study. But the trivium is really just focused on the components that make up reality, the things that we see. If I look out the window, well, I see the glass of the window. I see the blinds. I see a wall outside, a street, a car going by. These are all nouns, things that I can identify.
Don't those things exist whether or not they have nouns? What about things that, like, say, a new
sure
element?
Sure. But, I mean, humans, when we interact and when we discuss them, when we want to talk about them, we bring them into what is called the commons. Okay, and so if there's a new element, okay, if you make up an element, let's say you channeled it from Uranus or the Pleiades, and you can just say, okay, I have this green fairy element sitting here. And you say, well, I don't see it. And I say, no, it's right here. You don't believe me. You're not spiritual enough. You're not this or that enough. You're just not perceiving, and I'll use some attack against you. When in actuality, the onus of proof is entirely on me to show this new element or that this fairy exists. Now that we show that the element exists, we, you know, multiple people can pull it up under microscopes, we can verify it. Now it's on the table, it's in the commons. All of us have common sense because of the commons. It's things that we can pull up on the table and we can look at. Now we can speculate about things that aren't on the table, the green fairies and the magic and the ghosts and things that we can't verify in reality. But then we get into what is known as arguing the arbitrary. And in logic, arguing the arbitrary, we can argue possibilities all day long, but it doesn't really get us anywhere. So when we get back down to the grammar aspects of reality, then we can say, okay, well, these are the things that we're actually dealing with. These are the things that we need to discuss. And then we can focus on them rather than could be's, should be's, maybe's, and possibilities all day long. And, you know, going back to the idea of just, you know, arguing the arbitrary, possibilities are endless. I mean, you know, you could say, oh, well, what if it's this or what if it's that and what if it's this and what if this really happened? And we can literally create speculations all day long. But what are the things that we're dealing with first? How do they fit together? Is it logical? And when we come across, you know, where we have to make leaps of faith without any evidence, or when we have to name call at people to dismiss evidence, or, you know, I'm going to call Jan Ervin crazy because he dared to, you know, say that McKenna, he dared to believe McKenna's own words and say that McKenna was an agent rather than arguing like the rest of us that McKenna was lying when he said that. You know, so, and we have done a lot of background on this stuff. So we can actually go in and we can look, do we have the evidence to support this hypothesis?
Okay.
Versus just making arbitrary speculations all day long with no evidence. So the onus of proof is very important.
Within the trivium, the way of thinking and evaluating reality that you're working with, what if 50% of people say, I see the green fairy element, and they can identify whether it's there or not there, and 50% don't see it? What happens
there? Okay, well, here is an issue. If 50% can see it, they should be able to show it to the other 50%. Have you ever found anything? For instance, if I hold this pen up, is 50% of the population going to say that this pen doesn't exist?
No, but 50% of the population may say love doesn't exist. They may say that the bitter taste in stevia doesn't exist because they cannot detect it.
Sure. Sure, love is an emotion, and I said, you know, the trivium is not about deciding whether or not you like or dislike the flavor of stevia. No. It's understanding if stevia exists or doesn't exist.
There is a bitter taste in stevia. I would stake my life on it. Yet you probably don't taste it. How does that work? It is there. I can sense it, and some people can sense it. Some people can't.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I like stevia or not. I mean, something.
I'm not talking about liking. I'm talking about the presence of a bitter taste.
Okay, but like I said, the trivium aspect is dealing with grammar, is dealing with the items that compose or make up reality. So is you liking or disliking, or is stevia being bitter or not, part of it being in reality or not? No, so, it's not. So stevia, we do know both people can.
This is
what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is if I have a bottle of stevia sitting here. You and I can both agree that the stevia bottle is here. We don't have to agree if we like the flavor of the stevia or not. We can both agree this is a bottle of stevia. We can look at it. We can smell it. We can even taste it and be like, yep, you know, whether you like it or I dislike it, we can both agree and come to the fact that the bottle of stevia is there. Now, in this case, it's not there. It's in my cupboard, and I don't use it anymore.
So let's put it like this. We don't know what's in the bottle. So there's a bottle of stuff, and one of us takes it and says, it's a bottle of sweet stuff. And the other one says, it's a bottle of bitter stuff. And this seems like a trivial example. But what I'm getting to here is there are some things that people can perceive. One person's blind. I see this. I don't see it.
But if a person is blind, you can go up and say, okay, well, I'm holding a glass. Can you feel the glass? And you can take the blind person's hand and put it on the glass. The blind person can sense if this is in reality. Now, is the glass half full or half empty? Well, the person can put his hand in the glass and feel there. Oh, look, there is something. Okay. Oh, it's water. It smells like water.
Then let's talk about fog.
So again, we're not. Okay, fog. Yes, I mean, if we go outside and you know, we're driving down the mountain highway here, and it's really foggy. You know, you're going to get a line of cars all bunched together. They're driving slow down the mountain. They have poor visibility. They can probably agree that it's fog. Now, a blind person, they may not see the fog, but I, you know, if we take them out of the car, can they feel the moisture and humidity on their skin? Can they feel the cold, you know, the cold dampness in the air, etc.? So there are ways through five sense reality that we can verify things out there. We don't live in a Kantian quantum delusion where we just make it up. I mean, you know, Dave, I mean, how come not, you know, I'm just going to will it and I'm going to be sitting in your seat and you here. Wait, it didn't happen.
It sounds like a
Oh, darn.
Sounds like a good movie, though.
It sounds like, I mean, it, you know, it sounds like
I get it.
A dozen movies already made. But, you know, essentially what we're dealing with is components that we can verify. Now, if I hold up this glass, I can tap it, I can smell it, I can taste the water in it, you know, I can hear the sounds it makes, etc. I can feel it with my hands. So these are all things that we can verify in five sense reality. Again, going back to the words on the page. We can verify each of the words on the page. So, now, if somebody refuses to read the page, that's entirely different. They can say, well, I'm just going to ignore it. But then they don't know the grammar or the contents of that page, and they have no standing to discuss it.
So let's talk about how someone – okay, so the first step someone would go through to understand the trivium is, well, obviously read the stuff about it. Okay, so let's assume someone's read about it, and then the next day they're saying, all right, I'm going to start applying this to my life. Like, what's it going to do for them, and how will they go about applying it?
Well, you know, at first there are steps. Essentially what happens is you start to learn it, and most people pick up on the logical fallacies first, and because especially the informal fallacies, because they're the quickest and they're the funnest to learn, and you can sit there and you can, you know, debate with your spouse or turn on the TV or listen to the radio and just watch the fallacies come at you and see if you can identify them. TV commercials are fantastic. Your average 30-second TV commercial will run about 40 different fallacies. And so if you can identify the fallacies, you can actually see how the media is beginning to manipulate you. The
Give first me an thing, example.
I'm not sure that okay, most of the people hearing this are understanding what you're saying.
Logical fallacy. Let's say you know, it's a commercial for men's hair products, and you know they're playing on men balding or going gray. Let's use the gray thing, and then, you know, you're not going to get laid if you don't get our hair darkener. So what they're doing is, you know, they'll show pictures of women and the woman's knocking on his door, you know, or if he's got his gray hair, there's just no chicks coming at him at all. He gets some of this hair dye. All of a sudden, the women are running down the street. These are appeals to emotion. Essentially, they're appealing on the guy's fear of being single or being alone and all of these types of things. So when we learn to understand how these, you know, the appeal to emotion fallacies work, then we can see, oh, you know, they're using these things. Or a Budweiser commercial, you know, oh, they got the four girls with the Budweiser across their chest. Oh, look, it's an appeal to sex. They want me to associate boobs with beer. And so these are things that when we begin to comprehend how the logical fallacies work, then we can catch them, filter them out through information coming in via our five senses that we were just discussing.
Now, what if, Jan? Let's say I've read the studies that say that being with a partner means you have less chance of dying at a young age and less chance of having cancer and high blood pressure. All those are true, by the way, if you're in a good relationship. All right, so you've decided you want to be in a good relationship. Now, the guy selling hair product online says, okay, so you have a better chance of being in a relationship if you buy my chemical hair stuff. Am I not being a rational person if I pay more attention to that ad because it's something I'm interested in and I know that it would benefit me?
Now, is the person who is presenting the information, he's saying, now here we have 15 studies that show these specific facts. These studies have been verified through all of these different universities and peer-reviewed, et cetera. We know that these things are true. This is why I'm saying this. You will be healthier if you find a spouse. But you know what? I'm not going to associate it necessarily with a beer commercial or with insecurity of my hair color. Now, I suppose if you think that you're going to get into a strong, long-lasting relationship over your insecurity over your hair color, then you might want to rethink that. Okay.
So it's a fair point.
So, you know, these are things that we can look at. You know, is my being fearful over my hair color? Men have been getting bald forever, and, you know, people as they grow old, their hair changes. Is this something bad, or is it, you know, I can be considered wise? I can, you know, I mean, certainly I have more wisdom than my 7-year-old, and, you know, not that my 7-year-old isn't quite bright and doesn't learn very quickly as he does. It just means that as we get older, we have more wisdom, we have more experience, and hopefully with a little bit of critical thinking, we can learn to filter our emotional fallacies out. Now, going back to what I was saying, though, as the information comes in via the five senses, we learn to filter the fallacies and false information out. We're essentially checking it instantaneously as it comes in. Now, we also have all of this information in our minds. Now, 85% of the information in most people's minds has not been verified. It's just stuff that they heard somewhere else, and they typically repeat it.
Now, hold on. So was that 85% from a study?
Well, you know, it's something that we've, my friends and I have discussed at quite some length. And I mean, just doing it's like, ooh, check mark. You know, what are all the items in my mental palace that I have verified? But let's just say, you know, without a percentage, most of what most people know is BS. They have not gone out and verified information themselves personally. And they say, well, that would take too much time. Well, let me put it another way. You can go through your entire life with false beliefs and not spend 5 minutes to check them. So what is faster? What is better for you to make proper decisions on down the line in the future? Going out and spending 5 or 10 minutes, I mean, today with Google and things, you know, it often only takes a few minutes to verify if something is true or false. Or if you look it up and the right away the person is name calling, oh, this is false because that guy is a jerk. It's like, well, that didn't address a single point he raised. Calling the guy a jerk is just name calling. What does that have to do with anything? So then you can look through that. Well, he's a jerk because he lied about this, and here's the citation. He lied about that, and there's the citation. And we can go through and we can verify these things. And you can say, aha, okay, here's more facts, here's more information. You can also dig down further if there are still contradictions and get down to the truth of the matter. But the idea is that you have a systematic method to filter information coming in via the five senses. And also, after what happens, and going back to your question about, you know, when people start to learn it, what happens is after about 2 months, people begin to catch the fallacies in their own thoughts and remove them. And, you know, and you'll see people start shedding a lot of false belief.
That's why I wanted to have you on the show, was because of that thing. If you develop the critical thinking skills and you start applying them to the weird crap that comes up inside your head, pretty soon you start becoming aware of behaviors you're doing that are not based on reality. They're based on amazing edits that your nervous system can make to reality.
Exactly.
So this is one of the paths that I've identified to developing more awareness of those weird internal, what I've started calling the meat operating system, you know, the things that are going on in your body.
Well, let me just interrupt you saying, let's use Dave Asprey as the perfect example here. I mean, you know, we have Sally Fallon, Dr. William Davis, Dave Asprey, pretty much the key people out there, maybe Denise Menger, the key people out there getting people back on a healthy dietary track. I mean, if I go to the local grocery store and I see the woman over there in the bread aisle buying some bread and buying low-fat milk over in the dairy section, and it's pasteurized and all this stuff, and I walk over and say to her, you know, that stuff is really bad for you. And she might look at me and say, well, you know, my brother had a heart attack and died at 42. And it's like, okay, well, what does that have to do with low-fat milk? Well, my doctor says that high-fat and saturated fats is bad for you. You know, obviously, there is a lot of disinformation out there, and people like yourself and Dr. William Davis, Denise Menger, Sally Fallon has spent years going through and pulling up the facts that saturated fat is not bad for you, that the polyunsaturated fats cause oxidization and poison us, that the, you know, grains contain mycotoxins, the proteins we can't process, they're loaded with sugar, you know, all these mycotoxins, all this stuff that we can't deal with. So you guys pool together all of these facts, and you know what? I can personally tell you, Dave, after having you on my show twice, that out of maybe 1,000 respondents between yours, Sally's, and Dr. Davis's shows, 100% of them, without exception, were positive feedback from people saying that they had dramatic life and health turnarounds. Not a single person, period, wrote me to say, I went on a high-fat diet, I started eating the butter and the salt every day, and it made me sick and worse. Not a single one.
In terms of full disclosure, I finally found one guy out of hundreds of thousands. I had one guy who got liver ischemia, and we still don't know why. I'm working with him on figuring it out, and you know, he's talked with his doctor a lot. And I I don't know if it's genetic, but now we have one case study of someone who didn't do better on the diet, but out of the sample size, it's amazing.
And then you have to, of course, dig down and do your grammar going back to this issue and find out what happened, where the contradiction was. Was there some other factor in his health or environment or whatever that actually caused that?
We're working on that. So it's actually gratifying. Thank you for letting me know that you've had that kind of response. That's what this is all about, right?
Sure. I mean, you know, and I did that show with Mike, just to interrupt you real quick. Mike, what was his last name? Adams or something. I forget.
Yeah,
but we
Health
did a
Ranger,
whole show on
Mike Adams. He's awesome.
The guy who had cured his MS, excuse me, while I pull up my own website here.
Terry Walls?
The guy who had cured his MS. With your advice, Michael Adams, curing MS with the paleo diet. I just simplified it with paleo. But that was the guy that had wrote after our show. He had MS. He couldn't. He had a 3-year-old son. Couldn't take care of his son. Couldn't work anymore. And after a few weeks of no weed and high fat diet, he was back in high gear.
Wow, that's so cool. Love hearing that. I want to switch gears if you're up for it. In our conversation.
Oh, sure. Sure,
there's
why not?
Two more big topics. I've done ayahuasca in South America, and I don't believe in recreational use of psychedelics. I think it's kind of dangerous, but I've certainly, in my own experience, had some benefits from it, and I know literally hundreds of people who believe that they gained better awareness of their internal voices, even so they could apply trivium to it from specific targeted use of psychedelics. What's your take on these things? Like, what's their role in our culture, and are they dangerous? What's the deal?
Sure. Well, that's quite a double-edged sword there. I've been an ethnomycologist for more than 20 years. I've written a couple of books on psychedelics. I've got a 1,000-page manuscript sitting over there that I haven't published.
You're the right guy to ask, in other words.
About 6 feet from me. But, I've taken, and a lot of people will attack me. Jan Ervin, how could he dare say that McKenna and Leary and these guys were agents? Well, they said it themselves. I didn't say it.
Well, when we say they're agents, what do you mean agents? Like agents of what agency or something?
Well, most of them were MKUltra operatives under the CIA, instance.
I have to pick your brain about that. Okay, cool.
Okay, well, I mean, we have there's a documentary or a video called A Conversation on LSD where Tim Leary is sitting in a group of people who we know, like Oscar Yoniger, we know is MKUltra, Sidney Cohen, we know is MKUltra. He's in a room of these guys, and he's talking about our undercover agents that were traveling around. It's like, okay. He's in a room full of CIA guys, and he's talking about his undercover agents, right?
So for our listeners, I think some of them probably aren't on top of what MKUltra even is or was.
Okay, good point. So MKUltra was a CIA program that ran from around 1953 or 1956 in through the early 1970s until it splashed all over the media due to the Frank Olson murder. The CIA had murdered one of their chemical engineers, Frank Olson, and threw him off the 10th floor of a hotel in New York to hush him because he was going to go public about the CIA's LSD experiments on the entire village of Pont Saint-Esprit in France that killed 5 people. And when he got back from that whole thing, he panicked, and then George Hunter White for the CIA had him killed. And then this brought the Church Commission about, which blew the roof off the entire operation.
So to get this out for people, about 40, 50 or so years ago, the government was doing some psychedelic experiments on people without their permission. All right.
On entire villages, entire cities. In fact, we have Operation Midnight Climax up in San Francisco, and there was another location also where basically they would have little brothels set up, and they would bring Johns in to have sex with these women who would dose them unaware, and then the CIA guys would sit behind glass and giggle at these guys going out of their mind and do so-called studies, observe these guys going out of mind and collect, blackmail information and stuff on them, etc. But the idea was really to see how they could use psychedelics to confuse people. Now, the military, I should mention, called psychedelics psychotomimetics, which means psychosis mimicking. It was Aldous Huxley and Humphrey Osmond who renamed them to psychedelics. And then later on, Gordon Wasson, who is the propaganda manager for J.P. Morgan Bank, and he also headed MKUltra Subproject 58. He and Professor Carl Ruck at Boston University renamed them yet again, or remarketed them the third time, to entheogens. Now, back to your question, you know, what do I think about the value of psychedelics? Have I tried them? One of the biggest attacks I get when people are new to my work and haven't read my books or the first 10 years of my research or my stuff stored at Purdue University's Psychedelic Archives Library forever, they think that I've never tried psychedelics. I have, in fact. In fact, I've done psychedelics more than 1,000 times. I've done ayahuasca.
What's your favorite one?
My favorite is, or was, mushrooms. I'm finding, as I've gone through and done them so many times, I'm finding less and less benefit from them. Now, you know, my co-author, Joe Atwell of Caesar's Messiah, and I were at different odds because I came through the psychedelic community to see the mind control, and I can also see some of the benefits, but they're very dangerous. And what I can tell people is, without a systematic method of processing information like the trivium, you can get yourself in a big mess. Now,
agreed. By the way,
the information that we have exposed on the psychedelic community and on its founders shows that it was a CIA mind control operation. Now, you can ignore that. You can call me names and call me crazy all you want, but it doesn't dismiss the fact that the quote-unquote discoverer of magic mushrooms was the PR man for J.P. Morgan Bank, Gordon Wasson, and headed, as we have the CIA documents for, headed MKUltra Subproject 58.
Hold on a second. Isn't that like saying Columbus discovered America when it was full of Indians? I mean, like,
that's why I said, quote unquote, okay. Discovered. Okay. So now, obviously, the Mazatec Indians, who I give full credit to, had used them for hundreds or thousands of years before that. But he is the quote unquote, quote unquote,
the Western guy.
Discoverer.
Okay.
The Western guy. The rich white academic who brought it to the CIA and made them popular. We can put it that way if that makes better sense.
Got it.
And so he is accredited for discovering them, and he is the one who popularized them in the May 13, 1957 Life magazine article, Seeking the Magic Mushroom. Now, Timothy Leary, a self-admitted agent, he claims to have gotten his knowledge of psychedelics from that article. Never mind, they all work together behind the scenes. That's a different subject that you just got to ignore and pretend that doesn't exist.
Okay.
But we know that Leary and Wasson were agents, their own words, their own documents, etc. So these are the key guys that found it. Not only that, we have a lot of information on Aldous Huxley, which we can go into it in a bit.
Okay. So your position is that the adoption of psychedelics in the West was led by government mind control MK Ultra stuff,
right,
rather than something else.
Right. Okay. Now let me put it this way. A lot of people will get confused here. Now, how could that be? Well, if we look at the origins of ethnobotany and ethnomycology as a field of study and what its purpose was, originally I thought it was to study the spiritual practices of ancient cultures. But what if it was actually more to study how shamans kept control of those cultures? And when we think of the shaman becomes the priest, the king, the government, we can see a line of progression there. And, you know, these guys wanting to get back to the stick with simple stuff of how the shaman controlled the stuff. I mean, in many cultures, the shaman was the huckster, the trickster, the manipulator, the guy who did the sleight of hand and stuff. You put on a headdress, you do some peacocking, and you know, you get all the women swarmed around you, right?
Kind of like the presidency, right?
Right. Well, sure. or you know, any Hollywood thing, they show, you know, some star with a bunch of lights flashing, and look, everybody goes and they run after them. This is actually, when you get into Edward Bernays' earlier stuff, Edward Bernays actually created the pop culture idols. Anyway, what we're looking at is how these cultures use them for control. Now, there is also other aspects to them. I'm not saying that some form of spirituality doesn't exist. The quadrivium does show that something is out there, but it's not in any of the books that we've seen so far today. I mean, everything that I've seen so far is agenda laden. So we're not saying that something doesn't exist, because if I stick a bunch of chemicals in a bucket together, I mean, it doesn't create life. And so something sparks that life.
Okay, so you have a very distinguished background in psychedelic research, and you acknowledge that there is some spiritual spark out there, but we're still figuring out what it is, if we ever do. Okay, that's a
let me say just one more point before I let you continue on. Now, here's an issue that, you know, I've sort of been contemplating, is we have these stories in the Bible of the tree of life and the tree of knowledge and the fruit and Adam and Eve eating this fruit. And what if all of this was put there as a warning because this had happened before? Now, when we get into the history of psychedelics, the Lucinian mysteries in ancient Greece, etc., this was a government-sanctioned psychedelic religion that lasted for 2,000 or 4,000 years. I forget which right now. But it was government-sanctioned for that length of time, for thousands of years.
Who cares if it was government-sanctioned? I mean, governments also sanction things like feeding people. That's kind of
because it's sanctioned by the government, and it was controlled by two families for thousands of years. And so when we get into the history of this, when psychedelics are supposed to create individual spirituality and independent thought and all of this stuff, we can also see the other side of that, how a government can offer psychedelics and say, you know, and become the good guy. Say, oh, look, see, we're giving you this. So now we're the good big brother. We're here to nurture you, even though we can read our history books and Plato's Republic and all of this stuff and know that they were up to the same shenanigans as governments today.
Okay. I think there's probably a lot longer conversation we could have
around
psychedelics, but we have to get to transhumanism in order to fit this into our interview.
I do recommend people jump on my Manufacturing the Deadhead article with Joe Atwill on the Gnostic Media website. It goes into a lot of detail on these issues there.
Okay, we'll put a link in the show notes to that, and people can Google for you. So it's Manufacturing the what?
The Deadhead.
Manufacturing the Deadhead. Just Google that and it should come up first, I imagine. You've got a good amount of traffic on your site.
Right.
Okay, cool. Let's talk transhumanism. You've come out flat out and said it's, you know, a MK Ultra, I believe, plot to...
Well, it's not MK Ultra plot. It's the people who were involved in MK Ultra were directly involved with the foundation of transhumanism as well.
Okay, and why is... So for people listening who haven't heard of transhumanism, there's a couple different flavors of it. One of them is we're going to upload ourselves to a new kind of internet and, this is the Ray Kurzweil singularity stuff.
Sure.
And the other one is, we're going to upgrade ourselves into, basically cyborgs.
Right.
And I would argue there's a third branch of transhumanism, one that you could say I'm a believer in, which is that you don't really need to replace your hardware until you've taken advantage of the hardware you have already. Call it the overclocking side of things.
Well, I would be in the third camp with you there. And, so let me be clear that I am not against upgraded self and taking, excuse me while I sip some bulletproof coffee.
I guess that means you're not against the upgrade itself.
Yeah, point. You got my point there. And so, what we're looking at here is looking at the trivium, the transhumanists will argue that, people are not getting smarter. And, they're just dumb. Well, I have quotes from Aldous Huxley where he says 99.5% of the population are imbecilic Philistines. And so... the issue is when we get into the study of the classical trivium and quadrivium, we see how this education has been withheld from the masses since at least Plato's Republic's time, at least 2,500 years. We know from dictionaries and write-ups on it that it was always used to control the masses and manipulate them. It was withheld from the masses. And so this is why we're helping for the masses to get. The only way it can be used against you is if you don't have it. So my point here is that with intelligence and thinking, if you remove critical thinking, if you remove people's ability to gather information properly, then they're not going to be as thoughtful and as critical thinking or as intelligent, and then you're going to sit there and you're going to complain about it. Now, for instance, I have this quote from, let me see if I can find it here, from Sir Thomas More somewhere. He says, "For a few, the rulers suffer your people to be ill-educated and their manners to be corrupted from their infancy, and then punish them for those crimes to which their first education disposed them. What else could be concluded from this but that you first make thieves and outlaws and then punish them?" And so what we have is this problem, and it's found throughout the compulsory education system today. John Taylor Gatta's work, Charlotte Iserbeet's work, et cetera. They've spent, you know, dedicated their lives to expose the dumbing down of the compulsory education system. So obviously, the dumbing down isn't a hardware problem. We don't need our brains upgraded. We need the compulsory government education removed and the classical arts brought back.
It is a hardware problem. If your mitochondria are broken because you're eating what some people have called slave food, wheat.
Sure. Well, and I agree, and that's another issue, because if we were taught the proper critical thinking and the proper seven liberal arts, we probably wouldn't be eating the cow and pig food in the first place. And so, you know, there is that level also, the realization of what is food and what isn't. I mean, without the Trivium, I may have come across your stuff, or I may not have. But with the Trivium, I was already on the path. I, you know, fought looking at Sally Fallon's work for years, and then I finally got that little bit, and then I finally stepped over to Dr. Davis's stuff, and then I finally got over to your stuff and mycotoxins, and then when I got to the mycotoxins, it was.
Given your background in studying psychedelics, that's why you connected that so well. Even most of the paleo community hasn't got the mycotoxin thing. Now I just understood why you connected with that. Okay, cool, because you've studied some of it.
Well, you know, and not only that, I was in and out of the hospital for 15 years and got sick and tired of being sick all the time. Got sick and tired of being sick and tired. So, you know, in 2009, after the doctors here in the States had, you know, 12 of them had totally proved their incompetence, I took a trip down to Arequipa, Peru, and found a Harvard-trained gastroenterologist down there who cured two of my problems. And I left Peru no longer feeling the constant gastrointestinal pains. But when I got back to the States, the irritable bowel syndrome and other problems started reappearing right away. And it was a really weird, well, you know, I was totally healthy in Peru. What happened right when I got off the airplane? And so, of course, it was the mycotoxins and the weed and the processed foods. And, you know, of course, the grain-fed beef and all that stuff isn't much better either.
Well, you really have felt it. Okay, cool.
Oh, I mean, I am you could call me somebody who is extremely hypersensitive to toxins in the environment. So, you know, if I get something bad, I pretty much react immediately.
I got it. So you've got the canary genes. Not so fun. Well, let's go back to the transhumanism thing.
Blonde hair, too.
That's right. At least you're not a redhead. Redheads have the most trouble. Seriously, it's really amazing. But the sensitivity to anesthetics, everything's different when your hair is naturally red. Notice I said naturally. But now let's go back to transhumanism. All right. So you've got the canary genes, and maybe we really should upgrade your hardware. I mean, let's do some viral slicing of some genetics.
Sure. Clearly my stomach is bad. I need a metal mechanical stomach to function. And, you know, my heart, just to make sure I never get heart disease, that just needs to be cut out and replaced.
Why not?
Or you know, I mean, I don't put crackers in my Jeep. How about I don't put them in my stomach either? You know, my Jeep runs really well on oil. Is there something to that? You know, my body runs really well on oil, I find out. You know, if I take a cracker and I light it, it just kind of flashes. You know, not that the law of thermodynamics, do I think, plays any part whatsoever on dietary calories. You and I have talked, you know, about the absurdity of that theory in the past. But, you know, it's like how the body absorbs calories isn't necessarily how a flame absorbs something under it. But
I get you there. But the point about transhumanism is that wouldn't you like to be more resilient? Like, let's say that we could replace parts of your GI tract with a cool, you know, let's say with a cool non-biological system versus just better cells.
I don't know. I mean, would it make me feel better? Would I perform better? Or would eating the proper fuels do the same thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course,
I mean,
it might do the same thing, but I mean, seriously, wouldn't it be convenient?
It did do the same thing, actually. I can
right, but it takes work. I mean, wouldn't it be nice? No, we'll just go on a limb here. If you could just like pick up a branch in the forest and stick it in your mouth, and you'd be perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I was a koala bear, sure.
Well, but you're either dodging the point or you're not hearing the question.
Well, so I get the point. I mean, to me, it's not a valid question. I mean, it's not looking at the root of the problem and looking for a real solution. It's
sure
looking.
It increases human resilience. Give me more fuel sources.
Okay. So I could get more fuel sources, but what would having a mechanical stomach do? I mean, would I enjoy food more? How would it absorb things? I mean, it raises so many more questions than it does solutions, and other potential problems and whatnots. That rather than, you know, I know if I eat a solid, strong, paleo, mycotoxin-free diet, I'm going to achieve that result. And I know, except for that one guy that you had, I know time and time and time again over thousands of results that the end result, except for that 0.00001 guy, the result is going to be the same almost every single time without doubt. And I don't have any of these, you know, drastic unknowns that we're going to have to deal with.
So your big concern there is the risk of transhumanism.
Well, I mean, you know, number one, I don't even like plastic boobs, but, you know,
oh, did you talk about what you like? Because this is not a discussion about what we like or don't like.
Well, okay, well, true that. Well, you know, there's questions there. Logically speaking, would I benefit with a metal stomach of some kind? I have no idea.
It's possible is all I'm saying.
It might be possible, but it could cause 10 times more problems than it would fix. And just, you know, the fact of going through a major operation to have a metal stomach put in, I mean, the risks and complications with that and so many different things to factor in.
Okay.
So when we go back down to the grammar level and apply critical thinking and we look at the options, we go, rather than eating tree branches, why don't I just eat the proper food? Then I don't have to go through all of this.
As long as you have an assured supply of the proper food, that makes great sense.
Right. And so, you know, this, of course, goes back to critical thinking and making sure that people and governments don't interrupt our proper food supply and provide us that healthy, pasteurized milk, you know.
I couldn't agree more. Jan, it's been fun to talk logic and rhetoric and psychedelics and transhumanism and a few other cool things along the way. We are out of time on our show today.
Already.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for coming on. Can you lay down your URL, your Twitter, your Facebook, and whatever other things you want to do? And then I've got to ask you one more question.
Sure. The main Gnostic Media website is just gnosticmedia.com. That's gnosticmedia.com. For those who want to study more on the Trivium education, that's triviumeducation.com, TRIVIUMEducation.com. And, you know, if that's the main stuff. I mean, sometimes I tweet or whatever, but I'm not too into that.
Awesome. And thank you. We'll put all those links in the show notes so people have access to your research and to your writing. Now, final question, the one I've asked everyone on the show. Top three recommendations for people who want to perform better based on your whole life experience. It doesn't have to be anything we talked about on the show.
Well, eat a lot of fat. Eat the fat off your steak. Listen to what your grandparents and parents said, at least in my generation. And, you know, ignore the dietary advice from the doctors to eat your healthy whole grains and that sort of stuff. Kill your television would be another good one. Listen to Dave Asprey and Gnostic Media.
There you go. A little plug there. No one's plugged themselves or anyone else in one of those answers before.
One of these days, I will have to put together a full show or something on just the transhumanism aspect, because there is such a vast amount to go in there, and it is surrounded with eugenics. We hardly touched on it, but the entire operation was created by the term transhumanism came from Julian Huxley, who ran the British Eugenics Society and UNESCO, and his brother Aldous Huxley did work for the CIA and headed MKUltra. So a lot there we need to get into one day.
I'd love to chat about it some more. Jan, thanks for coming on the show. Have an awesome day. If you're listening to the show now and you're in front of your computer not driving, I'd really appreciate it if you took a second to go onto iTunes and click like or give a review or whatever exactly it is you do on the iTunes app versus on the website. I always forget. Anyway, tell the world that this show is useful and fun and interesting. If you would, I'd sure appreciate it. Thanks again, Jan.
Thanks, Dave.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.